Hello, dumplings. Welcome to Let's Get Ugly, the podcast where we dive deep into the latest beauty, wellness, and lifestyle secrets that aren't always pretty, but always real.
We're your co-hosts, Trishna and Disha.
The sister duo keeping it 100% authentic, really silly, and sassy all at the same time.
We're super silly and definitely sassy. Now come join us and grab your favorite drink. And welcome to this episode of Let's Get Ugly.
Rosie, welcome to Let's Get Ugly.
Thank you for having me.
We're so excited because we actually know you as well. Yeah. And I think that will definitely come across in this episode. But it's great because you have such a career. You've had such a journey. And you're not just telling fashion stories. You're telling some of the most thoughtful fashion stories in a style that is so instantly recognizable.
100% agreed. And I just think, like, aside from that, your personal style, definitely going to be something that we want to learn from because we don't have that, really.
No, we definitely
yes, we
don't. But what I guess it's like when you look at Rosie, it's distinct. We can spot you from a mile away. You're always so put together.
Oh, wow. That's very kind. I guess you just haven't spot me down like when I'm going grocery shopping. That's all it is. It's just you found me at the right time. But that's very kind. Thank you.
Let's start with something personal. You've come from Hong Kong. You've lived in America. You're now in London. You spent some time in Paris. What do you miss most about yourself from 10 years ago?
I think I was a little – I had more energy, let's be honest. I was just telling Freddie how Fashion Week was a different beast back then. I used to travel from Hong Kong to do Milan and Paris, and we would, you know, be gone for 20 days straight, different outfit every day. The thought of that exhausts me now. And I don't think I'm even that much older. It's just – there are just some things that you become a little bit more jaded, unfortunately, about. I tried not to be, but I think, you know, the novelty of things wear off. And I'm trying to stay curious, but I think, I definitely have less stamina than I used to.
I think it's really interesting you say that because you're not alone. Like, I sometimes, and I think about it because I remember we had an event and Rosie was like, I'm going to come. And she came, which is like very un-London anyway. Like she showed up. But even though you weren't there for long, you were there. And it meant so much to us as well. And it was just the fact that you had like six events back to back in that one day. And I just think like, I could never do that.
Oof. I think I try to prioritize. And you guys are obviously a priority to me. I also think I like efficiency, and I think if I can stay on top of everything and get my life organized, then I can do as much, you know, all these different events and do a full-time job, etc. But I think ultimately you make time. You have to make time for the things that matter to you because there will always be a reason not to, you know, show up somewhere. I think London is difficult because people plan things, you know, months in advance, and people live far away from each other. I think that's also, you know, a valid reason. But I think friendships, for instance, like I think if we don't make this effort, then you also lose touch with people that you really care about. So I believe in making time.
I think that's really important.
It is. But I also think that's quite a Hong Kong thing because like back home, like you definitely have that instilled in you where you're like efficient, which London is not, unfortunately. But also the fact that like friendships really matter and catching up matters. And that's something that I personally feel is a bit lost here in comparison. It feels a bit more superficial here sometimes.
I just think that you can't be as spontaneous here, right? Because even restaurant reservations you need to make at least a month in advance, I feel. While as in Hong Kong, everybody's like 15 minutes away max. And so you can kind of just jump on a cab and, you know, meet up with someone after work. I do miss that a little bit. But, you know, it's just a different way of living. I think here you also have a little bit more of a work-life balance and people are more protective of, you know, the time that they get to stay at home. Like there's just these are things that I'm slowly learning to love as well.
I think that's so interesting you say that because it's so true. I remember actually offending somebody once because I was like, yeah, I can meet you in three Tuesdays. and they were like, what? And I was like, yeah, like I've got an evening free, but it's in 3 Tuesdays. And I just remember thinking, like, I can get how from someone anywhere else in the world, possibly that sounds insane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's so true to hear, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And then you sort of just have to lean into this rhythm. And then, yeah, and then everybody kind of abides by this unspoken rule. And, you know, you kind of get on with it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think it's really interesting because you're always there. But then sometimes we feel kind of invisible at the same time. Where do you feel invisible in the industry?
Sometimes I think it's a really good question. So I am an editor. I've always been. I think writing's my bread and butter. But I like to think that I can do other things. I have done a lot of other things, including, you know, events and, speaking on panels, but also content creation. And I've done brand consultancy for, you know, the founders that I know well. And I think it's really hard to explain that and just put it all on one name card. And so sometimes I feel like people see me just in one way. And it's hard to kind of change people's perception maybe of that. And I feel like where I don't feel seen is sometimes in the other ways that I feel like I could kind of bring things to the table.
I think that's so interesting.
Also because I feel like your career has evolved a lot and the industry has evolved a lot. So it was almost like if you didn't do all those other things, you almost lose out on gaining those skills, and they're so important.
I think we're expected to do so much now. It's not enough to just do one thing. And that's fine. And I like diversifying. I like, you know, sticking my fingers in different pies. But it is difficult then sometimes, for instance, if you are to apply for a job, you know, how do you explain that on a CV? And how do you, when you explain to someone what you do, I think people still expect that kind of short answer. But I think I'm trying to embrace the different facets of myself, and hopefully, like, other people will see that eventually.
I feel like it's so important because multi-hyphenates, which I feel like is more and more common these days, is actually a really important area to tap into. I know that we always kind of grew up in this, like, you got to specialize, you got to do good at one thing, but I just don't think it's good enough anymore. And I feel like you kind of create that mold as well, the mold of the unmolded in a way, which is really valuable and important, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in fashion, which typically was like, okay, you're either a designer or a stylist or an editor. And it's like, it was kind of one way of doing that. But you've been in the industry for a long time now.
Oh, yeah, a little while.
So you've seen all the changes and evolutions. But a fun question for you is, if fashion disappeared forever, how would you express yourself creatively?
I think I will. I'm always first and foremost a writer. And I didn't really start off my career thinking I wanted to be in fashion per se. It was just that in journalism school, we were asked to kind of pick a field, whether it's like broadcast or news or magazines. Then I was like, news is too intense for me. I'm too shy for broadcast. So magazines it is. And then within magazines, it's like, what type of magazine do you want to write for? My mom was always into fashion, and I was like, you know, that sounds fun. So that's how I got into it. But I am also a journalism major. I'm an English minor. I'm a Russian lit minor. I've, you know, literature is actually my home. It's just, what am I supposed to do with a Russian literature degree, you know? So I would say journalism is my vocation, and like fashion has become a hobby, but I will always write no matter what it is about.
Okay. So then that brings me on to my next question really nicely, actually. Considering there are, to an extent, so many different parts of your personality and compartments to what you do, even as a writer, what do you feel doesn't come through in your work but you wish it did?
The thing about when you write for publications is you're writing for a very specific audience, and to a certain extent you have to adopt a certain tone. It needs to be relatively homogenous with like the other people writing for the publication. You can't be, I never feel like I can be 100% myself. Mm. And for instance, even, you know, at Tatler, we're not supposed to use I. And so that really does limit, you know, how you can express yourself. So I think, you know, one day maybe I'll write a novel or something. But I think I really want to bring a little bit more of my background maybe through my work, because I think right now when you write about, you know, Asian experiences, it's quite pigeonholed. It's very certain. You have to be packaging it a certain way. And it needs to be seen through the lens of like maybe how the rest of the world see Asians. And I would like to see more nuanced voices out there. And hopefully I can be one of those eventually.
No, I'm sure. And I think actually it is missing anyway. Like, it's so true. There's kind of only one lens that it's being looked at from now anyway. And I feel like it's something that will really beautifully come together when the time is there. And yeah, we'll be in queue.
Oh, yeah, for sure. 100%. Like, we always look forward to, like, genuinely, like, when you put up articles, we're like, oh, what is she talking about?
Oh,
and like,
very
it's always exciting because it's such a refreshing way. Like, the way you look at fashion, and I can honestly say this, like, I don't think I've seen anyone ever look at it through that same lens, because it's so interesting and cultured and just well informed.
Global.
Yes.
That's what it is that we love about it. It's global. And that global approach has to come from experience, to be honest.
I try to contextualize fashion a little bit. I think that's where it's most interesting because it doesn't exist in a vacuum. I don't also think that writing purely – there's a space for it, of course, like, you know, B2B and industry-led stories. But I think people want to know why this matters to them, you know, on an everyday kind of level. What does it mean in the context of it all? Like, especially given the, you know, the economic crisis right now, cost of living going up, I think it would be too tone deaf to talk about, you know, buying something or luxury goods, you know, just as it is. You need to, if you're trying to convince someone to spend this kind of money on a new bag, you kind of have to contextualize it a little bit. And not to say that every piece that I write is like that, but I think for me, that's what I'm drawn to when I read stories. And I hopefully when I do write the features, I can add a little bit of that to the people who are reading.
For sure. Speaking of which, being global and living and worked in very different worlds, I want to talk a little bit about the move from East to West, because I feel like it changes a lot for all of us. But I don't want to look at it from an approach of fashion. I want to look at it in terms of identity and safety. When you first moved over, what changed for you?
Oh, gosh, I think it is a bit of a culture shock, even in ways that I didn't expect. I mean, obviously, I was terrified of it being too cold and too dark and rainy, and that was definitely true. Take vitamin D, everyone. But I think culturally, it's like you said, I think people in Asia operate a certain way. And it's kind of like you don't really interact. You don't really speak to each other in the elevator. You kind of like just kind of have your own personal space. In the U.S., it's another way, which is I think people are very vocal, especially I lived in New York. So it's like if they like it, they'll tell you. If they don't like it, they'll tell you. And I feel like here there's a little bit more of that sense of, keeping things relatively superficial at first, and then people need time to warm up. So I think it took me a while to understand that. Like, to give you an example, I think I am someone who takes things literally. Like, when I tell you I will come to your event. And I think in the beginning when I was meeting people, they would say, oh, let's hang out. And then I took that literally. And I was like, okay, well, when are we hanging out? And then you just don't hear from them, you know? And it's just I was eager to meet people as well. But also it's a cultural thing. And I didn't know that. And I think not that I lose my identity, but I think you have to adapt. You have to assimilate. It's as a result of that, I think I've become more like that, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. You just kind of have to adjust, you know, whenever you move to a new place.
That's so true. And it is really hard.
It is so hard. Yeah, the hangout thing, we had that too. And we would do the same thing. Because like back home, if someone says they want to hang out, it's like, okay, when are we doing this?
Yes.
But it definitely took time to understand that as a...
It's just a thing they say. It's just a thing. Yeah. We should hang out. Okay, are we really? Or are we not?
But I think the other way that, and just to add to that, when I first got here, I felt particularly, I'm here with my husband. So, I mean, I have him and it's a great support system and I'm very happy here. But I felt quite lonely around Chinese New Year because that's where it really showed how, you know, nobody celebrates that here. You can go to Chinatown maybe, but... And in Asia, you know, they paint the town red.
Literally,
like during that whole month, you know. And so the first year, it just felt so unfestive. And I didn't know what to do with myself. I was like, should we go for dumplings? Like, I don't know. And so I started to host my own Chinese New Year parties. They've gotten kind of bigger and bigger every year. And when my guests came, they were all, you know, expats and it just showed me how much we all miss that and miss celebrating that side of us that maybe we keep buried on a day-to-day basis, you know. Going back to Asia, you know, speaking Cantonese again, it's almost like I rediscovered a part of myself and realized that, you know, I only show maybe one side of myself when I'm here. But it's, again, it's just kind of the nature of living somewhere that's not home. But yeah, I miss that sometimes.
For sure. Do you think London is forever?
I think so. I mean, for now, I don't have any plans to leave, but I never say never. And my husband and I are very open to just kind of, if there's an opportunity that opens up somewhere, we're happy to go. But for now, we really do love it. I think the last 3 years that I've been here have been the happiest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing to hear, actually.
Yeah. It's really sweet, especially because, like, you know, London is one of those places that does constantly change. So it's about, like, finding a space that feels comforting even when the change is happening. Because it's changed a lot in 3 years. Like, everything is different, I feel.
But also, don't forget the pandemic.
Yes.
And that was so different. Yeah. So it's really interesting. I actually noticed a lot of things changed about myself personally after the pandemic, socially anyway.
I find that I'm a little bit more of a homebody.
Yes.
Since then, it takes a little bit more effort for me to come out now, but that could also be age. So
no, I think it's that, but also like if I'm out, then I want to do everything.
Yes.
So I want to start at 9 a.m. and I want to finish at 3 a.m. and I want to have
3 a.m.
and have every hour filled with something.
Rosie's not coming for this.
Yeah. I was like, how long is this going to?
No, but it's true. I even think with the pandemic, like even when it was like back to events, that I found so hard because like people didn't really want to talk, like they were kind of just there for the vibe and then would leave. And I was like, but conversations? No?
No.
Is that not a thing anymore?
I think people want to go home a bit earlier now. I think I've seen, you know, people are drinking a bit less as well, more into self-care. I do think that those are, to a certain extent, byproducts of the pandemic as well.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, we've heard a lot about wellness recently as well.
Yeah, for sure.
People are on a lot of supplement hypes and things like that. But it's a good thing. I don't think it's bad yet.
Yeah.
Yet. I think everything has a moment and then someone will come out with some research and scare us all.
Probably to me specifically with all the supplements I take. But this was pre-COVID. Like,
yeah.
I feel like I started the trend. No, I'm kidding. But shifting gears a little bit into fashion again, especially when you work with a lot of emerging designers in what you do, if they ask you like, okay, I'm talking to you, like, don't write about me yet to protect their growth, like, what would you advise them? Like, would you almost say like, that's a good thing, like, wait, or get your story out there from like an editorial perspective?
I've never been asked not to write about someone. I think everyone's quite eager for coverage and exposure. I think, you know, it is so hard to cut through the noise. And this is where publications come in sometimes to give that a bit of a sense of authority and, you know, bit of vetting, and that's what they can use also to expand their platforms. But I would say with young designers, definitely don't start a brand if you don't have a good business behind it. Like right now, it's just really tough. It's not enough to have a good idea. You need to kind of have your business mind or a partner, you know, who's good at that side of things, because that's the only thing that's going to get you longevity and to see you through some harder times. It is not good enough to just do a fashion show and say you have a brand. I've seen some, I mean, it's not to say that, you know, a really good idea eventually will get picked up and, you know, hopefully that will survive. But I think I've just, you know, with London Fashion Week, there's so many young designers and I've seen so many come and go that you do get a little bit better at identifying the ones that will make it.
Well, I was going to ask you, when it comes to like getting through that, cutting through that noise is one thing, innovating is another. If you were starting a brand in 2025, what way would you go? Would you be highly experimental, innovative, or would you play it safer? What do you think works in today's world?
I definitely think innovation is, you do need to do something very different from what is already out there because, you know, there's so much of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think consumers are also starting to have a little bit of fatigue as well. You know, it used to be a culture of, you know, choice and more is more. And I think now, like, again, with the cost of living, people are more discerning. People are a little bit more conscious about what they're spending on and what they're going to put their time and energy into. And I think if you're not doing something different in some way, then I think it's worth revisiting and thinking about.
One thing that I feel happens a lot now is that when people speak about innovation, they're like, everything is innovative. So what does innovation in the industry look like for you? Like, what do you pick up on?
It's a great question. I think right now no one's really cracked the proper use of AI. That is a huge topic, I know, and, you know, that would take up the entire, you know, hour. But it's no one's really managed to use it in a proper way in fashion that will really kind of alter the way people consume right now, the way people create right now. It's starting in small ways. I've seen it. But I feel like, you know, use it to it rather than be afraid of it, you know, really use it and see how you could take, you know, the creative process to the next level. I think, you know, textile innovation is definitely where it's at because, I mean, you've heard, you know, all the world is ending and we need to conserve our resources. And this was like, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, I've had a professor tell me how with clothing, that is some, you know, so much has changed in the internet age and we've come so far in many different industries, but a piece of clothing is more or less the exact same as it was from 100 years ago, you know, how it's made, what it's made from. And it's only in the last 5 to 10 years that we've seen steps taken to change. Why haven't we created something that will change with our body temperature and keep us cool? And, you know, with these really extreme temperatures that we're seeing.
Oh, yeah.
That's more urgent than ever before to have something that can adapt. Why are not more resources poured into this kind of research? So I think there's a lot of space to play with that, I think, with textile innovation.
I think that's really key, to be honest. I feel like it's one of those moments, I guess. Right now is the time. And I feel like you're absolutely right. I think that, like, innovation from a material perspective would make a massive difference.
Absolutely.
It really would. It would totally change the dynamic of kind of the way that we live as well. And it would solve a lot of problems.
For sure. And I think it is definitely an area that people should look into instead of like doing these like flashy shows and like things like that, which are fun. But in terms of real innovation, that is where it's missing for sure.
So tell us about the tricky things. We want to know about a time where it went completely wrong, but somehow turned out better than you ever imagined as a result of it. could be anything.
Wow. Okay. I suppose I used to do a lot of shoots as well. I think it is one of the toughest jobs to be, you know, a stylist, and you're working under crazy conditions. And we had a shoot in Amsterdam, and I was just staying for 24 hours. I was just basically there and then going straight to Paris Fashion Week. And so we had 24 hours to get this done, and it was pouring the whole day, the entire day. And we were supposed to shoot outside in these beautiful markets, and we were shooting for this Iris van Herpen feature. And so the pieces were really dramatic. And so we had to move everything inside. But what we ended up finding was this kind of creaky townhouse with like wobbly stairs and chandeliers that it just added to the whole mood. And the shoot was incredible. It was, I think, one of my favorite things ever.
Wow.
So I think sometimes you know, these are blessings in disguise and you can't control the weather. But yeah, you never know what's around the corner.
Yeah. It's giving Paris Olympics opening.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was wet.
That was sure. Very wet.
Yeah.
What was the last story or pitch that you fought for that others didn't understand?
Thankfully, I didn't have to fight too hard, but I wrote a feature on the confluence of fashion and haute cuisine. And lots had been written about that. I think there's this rise of food stylists, but I didn't really want to just talk about that. And the reason why I wanted to do the stories because I discovered that Michelin-starred chef Santiago Lastra of KOL, the Mexican Michelin-starred restaurant, a lot of the way that he plated his dishes were inspired by runway looks. And when I heard that, it just suddenly clicked that, you know, for me, fashion used to wear the food in like really kitschy kind of prints, the way that Karl Lagerfeld did it, the way that, you know, Jeremy Scott did it at Moschino. I think that was really cool. But I think now there's this sort of food is wearing the fashion. You've got really gorgeously plated food. And almost people eat with their eyes first now, mm-hmm. right? And so I wanted to do a piece more about that, more about how, you know, chefs have also sort of become influencers in their own right. And in New York, you've had chefs that have walked the runway. And I just think that this is only the beginning of that. And it took a little bit of explaining, I suppose, because it's not strictly a fashion story. But, you know, I had very kind editors and they really jumped on the idea. And I it was one of my favorite pieces that I wrote for Glamour.
Oh, wow.
That is amazing. I mean, we were saying earlier when you're writing, a lot of the time you have to stick to the tone of the publication as well. But do you ever feel like you overuse certain words or there's a word that you don't get to use often enough when you're writing a story?
That's a great question. I'm sure I overuse certain words. What do I do? I think, you know, when you start a paragraph with the question, I try not to do that because I do think it's sometimes a bit of a cop out, but I catch myself doing that a lot.
Yes. For online as well. It's like a way to hook people in.
Yeah, exactly.
So funny.
So I spoke to you about this immediately because when we were like, oh my God, we can't wait to have Rosie on the pod. Like so excited because we've been trying to do this for almost a year now.
Yes, I know.
But you are constantly on the move, but you look so good. So like, for example, in a Ryanair travel bag, in that tiny 40 by 30 by 20, how do you stay chic? What do you pack? What are you bringing?
So I believe in matching sets because that just will get – that's like three outfits in a set, right? You can wear it as a set. You can split it up. So I will pretty much always travel with a matching set. Maybe it's a printed one so it doesn't look too much like, you know, pajamas and you can actually go out in it. I also will always have a kitten heel of some sort just because you just never know. And look, if you even have pajamas, you put on a pair of heels and it kind of could work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then jewelry. You mean, have you ever seen me without a ton of jewelry?
No, no, never. I was actually going to say, it's looking beautiful today, but I was like, actually, I was thinking about it, and I was like, I bet she's going to say jewelry.
But it's true, because I do think that you could wear a t-shirt and jeans, and if you slap on some chunky gold jewelry, you do look more put together. I once left the house without my earrings by accident, and I felt so naked all day. I just felt like something was wrong, and I was almost went back to get them because I was like, this is not right. I'm going to be kind of going to be feeling really jet lagged all day. Just this is seriously how I felt. And that's because that's how important it is to me.
I think that's so interesting. I mean, it's so funny that like matching sets is what you've picked, because I can see it now.
Do you know what? Most people might say jeans or something. Mm. And I don't like wearing jeans because I just find it a bit too heavy and clunky, and it doesn't necessarily give me the kind of polish that I need. Depends on the jeans, obviously. Like, I love Trish's. These are really nice. But, like, I don't personally wear that a lot of jeans. I'd sooner wear kind of a matching pajama set.
So good.
Love that. And the jewelry tip, definitely need to take that on board. The more, the better, clearly.
So, you love a dinner party. We love your Chinese New Year party. We're gunning for an invite. Okay, if you had only three items from your closet that you could pick to host this party, what are you wearing? What's the vibe?
Well, Chinese New Year, I almost always wear red. Mm-hmm. I think that's a given. I also encourage our guests to wear red, and that's why I look so festive. But I think, and you know, most people might say a little black dress as well. I don't really have one, I don't think, just because I think there's a lot more interesting colors that could feel just like a chocolate brown could feel, at least on my skin tone, I really like a chocolate brown. You're never going to find me in super tall heels, because when you're hosting, you're walking around and you're entertaining, you know, you can't be hobbling around. And then, again, jewelry, just giant, giant earrings.
Love that. So chic.
So you. So you. Like, I can see it.
I have an outfit formula, and there it is.
Yeah.
It's no secret.
Stealing.
Yeah, we're both. You're going to see us rock up. We're going to be like,
coffee face. Yeah, exactly the same. Who wore it best?
Love that. Well, we have three quick fire beauty questions we ask every guest. Are you ready?
Okay.
What's one beauty rule you love breaking?
Ooh. Then I love breaking. Oh, my beauty routine is really, really boring. Oh, do you know what it is? Okay. I don't use a toner. I actually use micellar water again after I wash my face. Reason being, when I first got here, I had not eczema, but I was breaking out a lot. And I'm pretty sure it was the hard water. And we didn't have a filter yet at the time. So I always found that there was a bit of residue on my face after I washed my face, right? So then I would wipe it once more with my micellar water as if I was using a toner. It transformed my skin. So that's my hot tip for anyone who's struggling with that.
Love that.
Love that. So if you could give your younger self one piece of beauty advice, what would it be?
Yeah, lay off the rich creams, because I had temperamental skin, and my mother sort of gave me what she was using, which was definitely not the solution. And so it's one of those things where the more you put on your face, I think the more it kind of disrupts the what's it called, like the barrier. So I think I would have been better off without all these crazy creams.
Fair enough. And what's a beauty moment, good or bad, that you'll never forget?
Ooh, I really love the glam at one of the dinner parties that I did, so much so that I recreated it for the welcome dinner at my wedding, welcome sort of reception. And it's this just really long ponytail that was braided. And wow. I don't really have extensions. It was one of the first times I've ever done it. And I felt like Rapunzel, and I loved it.
Oh, that's so sweet. Love
that's
that.
So That's so interesting. I mean, extensions are a funny one, aren't they? Because it's like it's one of those things that you either love them and do them all the time, or most people haven't really ventured into them. But then once you do, you kind of fall in love, don't you?
I don't think I have the patience to do them permanently.
Yeah.
I just – my hairstylist, I have a love-hate relationship with her because she just knows I'm so boring. And she's kind of like, you could do so much better. I'm like, I know, but I just want it off my face. So, like, I can't have my hair down, like, ever. So, you know, that one time it happened and it was great. And, you know, it will have – I have fond memories of it and that's enough for me.
Oh, love that. Well, Rosie, thank you so much for taking us through your career journey as well as sharing interesting insights into journalism and fashion.
Yes, and we can't wait to see – where you end up next, whether it's in the world or in the world of journalism.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. This is great fun.